You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin's Attorney General is joining a lawsuit against the Trump administration's actions on the Endangered Species Act. An expert on that law joins the show to talk about its history, the impact it's had, and what the latest changes could mean.
First, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what you will. That was the labor movement slogan promoting a fair work week.
Problem is, my time off may not line up with your time off. And our guest says modern-day work schedules have made it harder and harder to plan time with friends and family.
Judith Shulevitz is author of the book The Sabbath World, Glimpses of a Different Order of Time. She wrote about work schedules and our social lives in The Atlantic. Judith, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much. From Eastern Time.
Thank you. Let's start by talking about what kind of jobs we're dealing with these inconsistent hours or the shifting schedules. Where do you see the problem?
Well, mostly the problem is with the low-income workers, particularly with hourly workers. Figures on how many hourly workers get less than 2 weeks of advance notice of when they're going to work range from 2/3 to 80% of the hourly workforce. So that's a really big chunk of people who work by the hour. On the other end of the spectrum are the high-income workers who are expected to work as much overtime as they have to, and that's often quite a lot, and they never come home, or if they do come home, they're not available to their children. So on both ends of the spectrum, you see people losing the ability to come together at the same time and not work together at the same time.
Sure. And it sounds like it makes it harder to plan, too, for even those big events, because if you don't know what your schedule will look like more than 2 weeks from now, or if you think you'll be expected to keep up that 60, 70 hour work week, it can be hard to even carve out the time to plan.
Right. So it has, you know, a very immediate personal effect on you and me, because we can't figure out whether we can, you know, make that niece or nephew's birthday, because we don't know if we're going to be working that weekend. And we don't know if we're going to be able to join this group of friends that have bowling night. You know, I'm not saying people are bowling alone. I'm just saying it's harder and harder to coordinate these things. In my world, more of us have resorted to the kind of scheduling software that first entered the workplace, like Doodle or Trello, to plan these events. So it just does affect our social lives, but it also affects our political lives. And that's something that alarms me, in the sense that it's harder to commit to going to rallies, to meetings, even to caucuses, if you're in a caucus state, if you don't know what you're going to be doing a week in advance.
Yeah, so let's go there then. How could this affect political engagement? Could it undermine our system of government?
Well, I don't know if it's doing that yet. I think it could, yes. I definitely think that in terms of organizing to change this, it's hard for people who are affected to get together and plan how they're going to take direct action. The good news is actually that there is a suite of protective legislation that is either in place or expanding. And in fact, Elizabeth Warren and Rose DeLauro, a Democratic representative from Connecticut, are reintroducing something called the Schedules That Work Act. So in terms of activism on this particular issue, it's hard to achieve, and yet it's also happening.
Is it difficult to help people understand what you see as real damage because of those inconsistent work schedules? I think if it were easy to see, maybe something would have changed before now.
You are so onto something. That is precisely the issue. It's really hard for us to wrap our minds around this idea of the synchronization of time, syncing up your time schedule with other people's as an issue. It just seems really odd. We worry definitely about long hours. We worry about not getting enough work. We worry about having enough hours in the week. But the idea that it's worth making an issue of having the same hours as other people in our family or in our community, it seems very nebulous and abstract. And yet it's one of the fundamental concepts of our society that we should have the right to have, you know, days off together, holidays off together, used to be Sundays off together. It's just something that it's very hard to explain.
We're talking to Judith Shulevitz about how that just-in-time work scheduling can make it harder to develop relationships and spend time with people. And Judith, it sounds like families really bear the brunt of people who work not being around or not being fully present at consistent times.
Right. The consistency of the time probably is worse even than the not being around, in the sense that it's very, very stressful. You can't organize childcare effectively. If you don't necessarily know when you're going to be working, you can't necessarily budget properly. People are actually going hungry. The level of stress of in the parents trying to hold all this together is actually affecting children. So there have been studies showing that children of people who work these kinds of just on call or on demand jobs are exhibiting more behavioral problems, more cognitive problems, more health problems. There was one study that showed more obesity among these children. So, I think it's having a real effect on families.
It sounds like the research there is pretty compelling. I would think, though, adjusting work for family is probably more palatable than friends. It seems almost kind of frivolous. It's not an obligation for us to get together. So what do we miss without the neighborhood chats or those last-minute coffee dates that were a thing before?
You know, in 1963, there was a Supreme Court justice who wrote an opinion on a case involving Sunday closing laws, in which he said this is actually really important to America as a civic body or a civil society. And he talked about the atmosphere of repose of Sunday. This was a Jewish Supreme Court justice arguing that stores should be closed on Sunday. And he was saying that this is the essence of our civil fabric, we can have time off together. So we haven't always thought of this as frivolous. He said it's the basis of, you know, community groups being able to gather, people being able to worship, and just the sort of amiable gatherings that make life really worth living in your neighborhood and in your community.
What you might see as an opportunity with so many people off, others might see as a disadvantage. If we're giving workers time off all on the weekends at the same time, it's a lot harder to buy the things that we need or go places we might want to go because nobody's working there.
Right. So Sunday blue laws are not coming back. We're not going to be able to get them back. That's not happening. And people certainly like the convenience of 24/7 stores. And obviously, people have to man or, you know, staff those stores. So we're not going to go back to a non-24/7 economy, but we can be more attentive to the needs of the people who do that work. We can at least tell them 2 weeks in advance, you know, what their schedule is going to be. Nowadays, many of them, I'd say about half of those who, you know, are on these kind of on-demand schedules don't know 3 days in advance what their schedule is going to look like. So we can treat them better, the workers who provide our 24/7 economy. And, you know, we can just be attentive to the idea within our own families that it is important to try to organize our schedule so we can get together.
We're talking with Judith Shulevitz about our modern-day work schedules and how they make it difficult to plan for time with family and friends.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this your life? Do you have a hard time finding time to spend with friends and family because of your work schedule, their work schedule? Are you on one of these just-in-time work schedules where you don't find out for a week or a day before your schedule? Is this putting an impact on your home and family and social life? And are you able to attend, say, the city council meeting or the hearing you want to go to or the school board meeting? Or does work get in the way of that, too? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about the way that our inconsistent work schedules can really impact our social lives with Judith Shulevitz.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel this? Is it a logistical challenge just to bring friends, family members, maybe your household together all at the same time? Do you see your schedule, your work schedule, or your spouse's work schedule, your friend's schedule getting in the way of things? How about participating in politics? Would you go to that public meeting, that rally, that hearing if your work didn't get in the way? And do you have this kind of scheduling where you don't find out what your schedule is till a week or a day even before you actually have to show up? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And this can deal with part of our system of government and how it's set up that might be contributing to it. Let's go to Troy in Muskego. Troy, what did you want to say today?
I just noticed, like, mainly in Wisconsin, especially in the last, like, 7 years, it seems like it comes down to when we have a government that lately has been catering more towards capitalism, and it caters more towards, like, the business owners. What I've seen is that workers almost, like, they'd have to work on the weekends now more, and the business owners themselves, a lot of them that own these big corporations, they're off on the weekends, they're spending time with their families, and they're making it mandatory for their employees to work on Sundays and on these weekends. So I think that's a factor as well, that the economy's only been benefiting business owners and not the actual workers.
Thanks, Troy. We appreciate your call. Judith, what do you think about that? Troy's seeing kind of an economic divide here between business owners and the people who actually do a lot of the day-to-day work.
Well, it's definitely true that when you go to work at something like a call center or Amazon, that you have to agree to be on demand, to stand ready to serve, as it were. And you have to agree that you will work overtime on demand. It's part of your training. It's part of the agreement that you make with the company. And it's certainly the case that the workers are being expected to put themselves out there in ways that their superiors, as it were, are not, or, you know, those who are over them. You know, the business owners at the very highest end are expecting their own employees, their executives, to work very long hours. But it is true that executives have more power to demand weekends off if they want them. You have to sign away your week if you are going to work at a call center, for example. So it is capitalism. It actually is. It's what's doing it to us. It's the need to, you know, increase those margins of profit by making sure that you're staffed at exactly the moment that your computer algorithm tells you you need to be staffed, and to move your people around so that you're absolutely maximizing your profits.
Let's go to Aaron in Port Washington now. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's your experience in your household?
So my wife and I actually have the exact same work schedule. We're both in education, and we have three kids. And I was calling to comment on kind of the, when we have downtime together, it's almost like a panic because we don't have things to do, because there's such a push to always be doing things and have kids and activities and post your pictures from the pumpkin farm and carving pumpkins. And when, like, for people who have schedules that are together, which is kind of ideal, and we don't have to worry about childcare, we really don't value that downtime together when we're just kind of in our house or in our neighborhood. So I was just kind of curious to see what your thoughts were on that.
Well, you hit the nail on the head. I really think social media is problematic here because, as you said, you're sort of always performing for your social media audience. And having those devices and having those computers around make you think of all the things you should and could be doing. You know, you could be ordering your food from Costco, or you could be, finish balancing that budget sheet. I don't know if you have to do that in the education business. Depends on what you do. But whatever it is, there's always this low-grade thought that you should be doing something more productive and that your children should be doing something that's going to make them look good on their college application rather than just hanging out and having fun. I definitely think there's just this sort of cult of busyness in our society that contributes to this need to sort of go off in your separate directions and do your thing on your device. When my kids started playing soccer, I thought of the soccer game as an almost a kind of technological Sabbath, right? You were not allowed to pull out your device because you had to be looking at your kid, because if you missed a goal, you were a jerk, right? More and more I see, my daughter still plays soccer, and more I see parents just sitting there typing away on their device, and I'm thinking, what are they thinking? This should at least be a moment when we're all gossiping about our children, you know, but,
right.
But it's not.
Right, because we set up those silos for ourselves. I mean, how do we begin to break those down then?
So I wrote a book about the Sabbath, as you noted at the beginning of the segment, and I do believe that there is this incredible social utility. And in the book, I try to prove that it's actually one of the fundamental ideas of civilization. It's one of the wonders of the world, that we need to put boundaries around certain times and just say, no, we're not working. We're not being productive. What we're doing here is important. We're having face-to-face contact. We're developing our relationships. We're creating the bonds of friendship and affinity and society and civic association, and that matters. How we do that, I mean, people are calling for a tech Sabbath. That's a sort of hot term out there right now. I think that's a good idea. I think it's a little hard to enforce, but I think that we just need to start talking about the importance of this together time. You quoted the labor movement sort of fighting for the 8-hour work day and the 40-hour work week. Now we need to be fighting for weekends and evenings, and we need to fight to have our employers respect that, and we need to train ourselves to respect that.
We're talking to Judith Shulevitz about our modern-day work schedules and how, because we don't have the same time off, we don't always develop the kind of relationships we want with one another. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Gwen from Madison, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello. I'm a registered nurse since 1978. And I have spent a career with my family adjusting their schedule for holidays and everything else around what shift I'm working and what holiday I'm on and working every other weekend. Now, healthcare workers are needed 24/7 in the hospital or long-term care facilities. And I can understand that. And I knew going in as a registered nurse that that's what was expected of the profession. But the idea that someone who is stocking shelves, working at Amazon, pulling orders, would have to work those same kinds of hours for, you know, holidays, weekends, mandatory overtime, the world will not end if I don't get my package. It's not like you're in intensive care here. And I think there should be regulations that, you know, do limit the kind of worker abuse that's going on nowadays, to tell someone that they have to wait till the day before if they know whether they're going to come into work or not is absolutely ludicrous. You can't pay your bills that way, take care of a family that way. And outside of the realm of health care or perhaps air traffic controllers, there is no profession or job that you can justify that type of working conditions.
Yeah, Gwen, well, thank you for that, for making that difference for us. Judith, what about that?
Amen, sister. you know, I don't know what else to say except yes, it is absurd. I think it's usually 3 days rather than 1 day, but yeah, there's one reason and one reason alone that they are adjusting schedules like this in places like Amazon warehouses and, you know, The Gap, actually, which is trying to do something about this, or other retail stores. And that is just simply because their computers tell them that there's higher demand. There's more demand for those boxes at Amazon, and there's higher street traffic or foot traffic at the store during those hours. And they're constantly sort of shifting that around. And that's simply about margins of profit. And, you know, obviously, if it's a zero-sum game, you know, if your competitors are doing it, you got to do it. But if there's regulation, then nobody can do it, then it won't happen. And as I said, there are Fair Work Week laws that are spreading around the country, and they have been introduced at the federal level. They haven't passed, but, you know, Philadelphia, Chicago, New York, Seattle, San Francisco, you guys need to get some in Wisconsin. That's all I have to say.
And those laws may be passed, but how do we legitimately really implement them and make them part of reality? You even point out in your piece, it's one thing to take Instagram off your phone so that you aren't, kind of distracted when you're around your family. But it's a completely different thing to decide that, you know, you're not going to fulfill the expectations of your workplace, that you need to respond 24/7.
Right. So there's also, I'm now forgetting the name for that, but there's sort of this no interruption regulation that requires employers not to demand and not to expect and to respect the time of their workers on weekends, and you do not have to answer emails during certain hours. And that's taken hold in Europe more than in this country, but that's also another way of doing that. So that's the regulatory way of doing that. I do think that we need laws to protect us, but I also think that with those laws, we need a cultural shift. We need to stop worshiping busyness and start respecting and not even thinking of it as downtime, right? We think of it as sort of empty time. That's the problem that the teachers were having, you know, these educators. They think of it, I mean, they don't. They're too smart to do that. But at the back of their mind, they're worrying that it's empty time. It's not empty time. It's important time. It's necessary time.
It sounds like we have a caller who speaks to that point. Stacy from Port Wing, we just have a moment left. What did you want to contribute here?
Hi, I just wanted to say that I think that that's the key, that we have to prioritize the time that we have. And if family is a priority, then we need to use that time, whether it's an hour or it's an entire afternoon or if it's just one evening a week, to say that. And our jobs are important, and I get that, and I understand that jobs have expectations for us, but we need to have expectations for ourselves and our families and put that first.
Thank you so much. Judith, sounds like you agree there.
I would agree with that. You know, I really started thinking about this when I had children, because children put you on this very different schedule. It's like a non-industrial schedule. You got to do what the child needs you to do when the child needs you to do it. And you got to just adjust your expectations of time. And you have to, it's almost like a kind of zen. You have to empty yourself out and be zen about it. And we need to recognize that there are these moments when human needs trump the needs of the workforce. Mm-hmm.
Judith, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Judith Shulevitz is a journalist and an author. We talked to her today about the effects of an erratic work week and how that can change the way we interact with friends and family.
Coming up, we'll look back at the Endangered Species Act as a multi-state lawsuit seeks to undo changes made by the Trump administration. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, half of churches across the country have congregations of, at most, 100 people. Find out how faith communities affect small towns and their economies tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, Wisconsin has joined a multi-state lawsuit against the Trump administration's rollback of the Endangered Species Act.
In a statement, Attorney General Josh Call says the new rules from environmental agencies are unlawful because they undermine key aspects of the act.
In addition to making it easier to remove a species from the endangered list, the changes weaken protections for threatened species. They also allow for economic assessments when deciding whether a species warrants protection. The administration says the rules modernize the Endangered Species Act and make it more transparent.
This law is credited with saving the bald eagle, the grizzly bear, and even the American alligator from extinction. In Wisconsin, more than 20 species are considered endangered or threatened.
Stan Temple is a professor emeritus of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. His expertise includes wildlife, wildlife conservation, and endangered species. Stan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, can you explain what you see as some of the key changes coming from the Trump administration when it comes to the Endangered Species Act?
Well, it's a lot to get through because the proposed rule changes are included in over 300 pages. But the analyses that have been done basically looked at all of these and came to some sort of consensus on which ones were going to be sort of detrimental to the overall goals of the Endangered Species Act, which ones were largely housekeeping type things that weren't necessarily going to be good or bad. But the ones that have caused the most concern, which you highlighted in your introduction, really are of concern because they definitely make it more difficult for the Endangered Species Act to achieve its goals. Probably the one that's attracted the most attention is the requirement that when a species is listed, that the appropriate federal agencies have to include an economic analysis that details the costs of saving the species from extinction. That is a way around the Endangered Species Act of 1973's wording that says you cannot include economic factors in determining whether a species gets listed or not. But this says you simply have to make the information known. The big problem with this is that it's one-sided. It only talks about the costs of saving a species. It doesn't include a cost-benefit analysis that would also do the economic analysis of the benefits that might be associated. The other thing that has caused a great deal of concern is removing the current protection that is afforded to threatened species. Threatened species are one threshold below endangered. They are species that are likely to become endangered in the foreseeable future if we don't sort of correct the problems that they're facing. And in the past, those threatened species have essentially received the same level of protection as endangered species. The logic for that is obviously you don't want them to become endangered, so you need to initiate protection earlier.
Another change would make it easier to delist species, as I understand it. And there's been an argument, Stan, that, okay, we've added lots and lots of species to the endangered list and taken very few off. Maybe we're too reluctant to take species off. Was that a point worth revisiting?
Well, it's an interesting case because it gets a lot of attention. Those that are arguing for changing the Endangered Species Act will say, hey, look, it's been around for 46 years, and only about 2 or 3% of the species that are listed have recovered, have come off of the act. So they say that's a failure. Obviously, that low rate of recovery means the Endangered Species Act doesn't work. Those that are supporters of the Endangered Species Act, in the sort of glass half full, half empty sort of perspective, they say, well, we look at it a different way. Of all the species that have received protection, only 2% have gone extinct. That means that we have almost 98% of the species that are listed that have not gone extinct, and that means that the Endangered Species Act is successful. So it leaves essentially the 95% of the species that are sort of between these two extreme sort of assessments of the Endangered Species Act that really ought to be of most concern to us. And there's been very little done to actually assess the status of the 95% of the species that are listed. For many of them, we simply don't monitor their status, and as a result, we don't really know whether they're increasing or decreasing or stable. For the ones that have been properly assessed, it's about 50-50. About 50% of them are recovering, are getting better, and about 50% are losing ground and continuing to decline.
Talking to Stan Temple from UW-Madison about the Endangered Species Act. Wisconsin's Attorney General added Wisconsin to a list of now 20 states challenging changes to the act. They say weakening the Endangered Species Act. These come from the Trump administration. Stan, can you talk us through the process under the Endangered Species Act as it's existed since 1973? How is a species added to that list?
Well, the process of adding a species is quite formalized. It can be within the federal government, it can be even a private citizen or some organization, can propose that a species be listed and provide some justification for why they think that is an appropriate action. Then the appropriate federal agencies, either the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Marine Fisheries Service, have to do an internal analysis to find out whether that request, that petition, is essentially warranted. And if it is, then the species is proposed for listing, either as a threatened species or an endangered species, depending on the severity of the crisis that the species is facing. And once a species is listed, then, of course, it receives all of the protective provisions of the Endangered Species Act. And perhaps most importantly, it includes a requirement that the federal government produce a recovery plan, some documentation of what is going to be required to prevent the extinction of this species, obviously, is the highest priority, but also in the longer term, to recover it to a secure status so that it no longer needs the protections of the Endangered Species Act. That can take a long time, of course. For many of these species, you know, it took decades and decades for them to decline and reach the endangered status. It's pretty unreasonable to think that it would take a shorter period of time to recover them from that status.
Arguing in favor of this change, there was an opinion piece in CNN from Interior Secretary David Bernhardt and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. They say the Endangered Species Act has led to frustration among landowners, states, some industries, and here's a quote from them. They say this is particularly the case in western states where the act and the impacts associated with listing certain species, like habitat restoration, requirements for human activities like farming and ranching, consistent monitoring, can become lightning rods for controversy. They go on, we can do better for our wildlife and the people asked to sacrifice for their conservation. So there is pushback, especially in western states, saying, hey, the Endangered Species Act is placing onerous restrictions on us. What do you think, Stan?
Well, this is a classic struggle that we have, dilemma that we have here in the United States between the rights of private property owners and the public's interest in something that is part of the public trust. And in this case, the endangered species obviously are part of our public trust. They're species that we all have an interest in, and that sometimes, in relatively few cases, I might add, comes into conflict with the goals of a private landowner. To solve that problem obviously means doing everything possible to make it easier for the private landowner to essentially become a partner in the recovery process. And that's done by entering into conservation agreements with the private landowners in which both sides agree to what they are going to have to do in order to promote the recovery of a species. It is rare, very rare, that the federal government sort of comes down on a private landowner and sort of forces them to do something without their sort of consent and agreement that they want to do this. So if we're trying to eliminate that conflict, one of the things that could be done but isn't included in these rule changes is to make that process of dealing with private landowners, and of course that's extremely important because more than three-quarters of the land in the U.S. is in private ownership, but do everything we can to make it easier to resolve any conflicts. And there's really nothing in these proposed rule changes that necessarily make that process any easier or more efficient.
We're looking at the past and future of the Endangered Species Act with Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison.
You can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the Trump administration's weakening of the Endangered Species Act? Are you worried about driving species into extinction? Or do you think the law has been too cumbersome for landowners and states and industries? The number to call is 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking about the Endangered Species Act and a multi-state lawsuit against the Trump administration's rollback of the law. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call announced this week that the state is joining that challenge, and Stan Temple is our guest. He's a professor emeritus of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. He's also an expert in wildlife conservation and endangered species.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions for our guest. Do you think the country's putting businesses and landowners ahead of conservation, or vice versa? Are you happy to see some of these changes to the Endangered Species Act from the Trump administration? How do you think we should balance the interest in preserving species versus economic development of various sorts? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Stan, another argument from the administration is just because we're giving up on, or we're making it easier to delist species, take them off the endangered species list, doesn't mean we're giving up on them. That's just transferring it to the states to take up once the federal protections aren't needed anymore. Is there an argument there?
Well, it would be nice if that argument held water. The problem is that most states do not have very effective endangered species legislation, and that includes Wisconsin. Our endangered species legislation goes all the way back to the mid 1970s, and that endangered species legislation in Wisconsin, as was the case in many other states, was basically pulled together to allow states to be eligible for federal matching funds after the Endangered Species Act of 1973 was passed into law. But for most states, and I really do mean most, their endangered species legislation is even more in need of revisiting than at the federal level. If that happened, and the states were able to have more effective endangered species legislation, then it might make sense to transfer more of the responsibility to the individual states that are involved in the endangered species, whatever that species might be. But right now, that is not going to improve the outcome for most endangered species, not the least of which is that there are relatively few endangered species that are restricted to the confines of a single state. So if the federal government passes off responsibility to the state level, it adds the additional sort of hurdle of getting multiple states to somehow agree with one another on exactly what the plan for recovery of the species might be like.
I want to bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kelly is with us in Milwaukee. Kelly, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yes, I am deeply concerned about a lot of the rollbacks that have happened with this current administration for our environmental policies, including this one. I feel like there's still so much that we have to learn about the interrelationship of all of the species. And if you lose one, it's a domino effect that so many others are affected and on which our very lives could depend. So that's a concern. A question I have is how are we assessing for new species to be added to the at-risk list?
Can you say that again? I'm sorry, I didn't hear all of that.
Thanks, Kelly. She was wondering where we are on adding new species to the list now in 2019.
Uh-huh. Well, actually, there are quite a few changes to the endangered species list that are going to be happening this year and in coming years. There's been a reassessment of the status of many species, and as a result, a surprising number of species are actually coming off the endangered species list. Some of them because they have legitimately recovered and no longer need the protection. For example, here in Wisconsin, we can point to some success of having the Kirtland's warbler delisted. It's no longer considered an endangered species. And although it has sort of bounced back and forth through the courts, the gray wolf, the timber wolf in Wisconsin, similarly has largely recovered and no longer needs the protection of the Endangered Species Act. But at the same time, the addition of new species has been somewhat problematic because administratively it's possible to put essentially a moratorium on the listing of more species, and that's been done a number of times through the history of the Endangered Species Act. So what we're faced with often is a very big backlog of species that have been proposed for listing but simply haven't yet been listed, either because there's been some formal delay in the process, or simply because the Endangered Species Program is so overburdened and underfunded that they just haven't been able to process all of them.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Stan Temple from UW-Madison about the Endangered Species Act. Wisconsin is now on board in a lawsuit against the Trump administration for changes to the Endangered Species Act. One of those changes that we haven't gotten into, Stan, I understand these new guidelines would limit the amount we could talk about climate change when it comes to endangered species. What do you see there?
Yeah, this one plays, you might say, on some of the language in the Endangered Species Act of 1973. And a lot of the language that was included allows for some flexibility on the part of the agencies that are going to be enforcing the law. And one of those had to do with when a species can be listed as threatened. And the definition, the threshold, is that it's a species that will likely become endangered in the foreseeable future. And the changes that the Trump administration has proposed focus on that foreseeable future. And what they have basically done is limit the time horizon in which the biologists who are looking at the species status, the time horizon over which they can decide that this species is going to become endangered. And it particularly, perhaps you could almost say strategically, was targeted to eliminate consideration of climate change as a factor that might cause species to become endangered as climate change is proceeding. Obviously, for species that are going to be affected, it's sometimes going to be some time in the future before they actually become endangered. So shortening the period in which you can consider the threat to them by climate change essentially means that we're putting off addressing their conservation needs by doing something about climate change.
Do you think that Congress should revisit the Endangered Species Act to adjust to new realities, possibly including climate change?
Well, it's hard to say whether it needs congressional action or not. Congress has always been sort of between a rock and a hard place about the Endangered Species Act. On one hand, it's one of the most popular pieces of legislation Congress has ever passed. It was virtually unanimously passed in 1973, signed into law by Republican President Richard Nixon. And since then, and right up to the present time, it's had anywhere from 85 to 90% public approval in every poll that's been taken. And Congress, of course, finds itself in a difficult position because they're often being lobbied by special interests who are in some way impacted by our national commitment to prevent species from going extinct. So on the one hand, they know it's an overwhelmingly popular piece of legislation that people don't want to see changed. On the other hand, they've got special interests saying we really have to do something to get the burden off our backs. So what do? They basically kick the can down the road, and they don't really do anything substantive with the Endangered Species Act per se. What they do is what the Trump administration has done, and that is try to tweak the rules, the rulemaking process, which is the internal process within the federal government, within the agencies, that determines how the law is going to be interpreted and enacted. And that can be done without Congress having to basically make a commitment. So those are the changes that we've seen, and those are the ones that the Trump administration has zeroed in on, things that can be changed easily by administrative action without congressional authorization.
Stan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
That's Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. We talked to him about the Endangered Species Act.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the firing and rehiring of a school security guard in Madison has drawn attention to zero tolerance policies in districts around the nation. We'll look at the impact of zero tolerance tomorrow on Central Time.
That's coming up tomorrow along with Food Friday here on Central Time.